My name's Kerry Carrington. I'm the publisher of the podcast series Remembering Randall. Today, you are going to hear from Jo Clifford, a former registered nurse who worked in Wollaston Park Mental Hospital in the 1980s. Her story's incredibly shocking. She had her tyre slashed for what she saw. So if you're ready, listen up now to the first episode with the registered nurse, Jo Clifford. Thanks, Jo, for joining me on Remembering Randall. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself, just something about your professional background and how you ended up coming to work at Wollaston Park?
I'd like to start by saying a bit about myself. Okay, I trained as a registered nurse from the age of 17, it took me 3 years to become registered. So I was very young. I'd come straight from school. But I left Wollaston Park very quickly. I then went on to do a degree in communications and media. And I worked for several ministers.
You became a registered nurse. You worked at Wollaston Park for a short amount of time, and then you did a degree, and then you ended up working for the Goss government.
In politics, So I was a ministerial advisor, and from there, I remained engaged in political work. I was on a couple of inquiries that I was appointed to by several ministers, involving things like child protection. I spent a long time working with a not-for-profit organisation called MICA Projects that involved an inquiry into a Senate inquiry into what was called the Forgotten Australians, which were about people leaving care. Yes, because their care was coming from orphanages and where a lot of abuse had occurred and so on.
So you worked for the inquiry into child sexual abuse for 7 years?
Yes.
Okay. So how long did you work at Wollaston Park and in what year?
I went to Wollaston Park straight from boarding school. I did this because on a Wednesday at boarding school, so the girls were allowed to choose an option. So I chose an option to work with people in aged care and also visiting the Toowoomba, as it was known then, asylum.
Yes.
I think Bailey Henderson.
Yes.
And I suppose, Kerry, I can't say what interested me in that work, except I wanted to have some understanding of what madness or what constituted madness, what people called madness, was about.
And that was in what, 19...
That was in 1978 and 1979. Like Wollaston Park, these were people who were chemically or physically restrained.
So you ended up in Wollaston Park in 1980, though.
The only reason I was accepted was because I had already been exposed to Bailey Henderson.
Yes.
And that meant something to them. It meant, okay, she's done that for 2 years. This won't surprise her.
So what wards did you initially work in?
As a student, you had to take a placement in every single ward that existed at Wollaston Park. The only place you couldn't work was in Pierce House to explain why, because under the Mental Health Act of 1974, that was meant to be a ward, as was Osler House meant to be a ward, for people who had been tried in a court and were held not responsible for their actions due to a mental illness. But as I soon found out, no women were ever allowed work in Pierce House, because it was for those people who were deemed had a criminal record but had some psychiatric problem.
And it was a male ward as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, all male ward, all male staff.
Yes. And Osler House was the female equivalent.
Yes, but of course there were female staff, but there were always male staff as well.
Okay.
And it was the same thing. It was those people who, mostly those people who, the women who had committed crimes and at the time deemed not responsible for their actions due to some kind of mental illness some kind of mental illness at the time. And so they couldn't go to jail. They couldn't go to prison, but they could go to Osler House.
And you had a couple of shifts in Osler House, didn't you? And you didn't particularly like it.
Yeah, I had a couple of placements there. So you had to do a placement as a student. And when I registered, I did another placement there. So a placement might last for 4 weeks. It's hard to describe the kind of feeling of being in a ward like that, where you have to open 3 doors with locks to get inside, and for men to be in charge of that ward that is full of women.
Okay, I just want to move on to a project led by Del Chenoweth on the Goodna Girls.
Yeah.
So can you describe to me how you got involved in this project?
Yeah, Adele, I know Adele quite well. She's done really great work. I got to know Adele through the Royal Commission, and what we tried to do was organise a meeting at a hotel in Brisbane. We met at a conference room with a group of women. There are about 8, I think, women who had been in Wollaston Park, who had been horrifically abused, to try and build a case for them to have a public hearing at the Royal Commission. And I, because I was the person that had the contact with the commission, Adele did a lot of the work bringing people together. I knew most of those women. In the end, I think the words back from the commission were that anyone who had been in a mental health facility, they would not commit themselves to a public hearing because they had a mental health issue, their testimony could not be relied upon.
So let's take one step backwards. These group of girls, collectively known as the Goodna Girls, were all of various ages, all of them as children, teenagers, 13 to 15, maybe even younger.
Mm-hmm.
They were as all state wards, and they were committed to an adult mental health facility for women as children, mm-hmm. not because they were mentally ill, not because they had a mental illness. So this is a real issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
They were put there as punishment, and most of them came from orphanages and Catholic institutions.
Yep.
Some of them ended up in Osler House.
Yes.
Do you think that's phenomenal? How could young girls who are in fact themselves victims of all sorts of abuse end up being put into a locked up mental health institution for forensically defined women, some of whom were murderers.
Yeah, murderers. I think of the context, like the bigger picture. These are in the days of a Bjelke-Petersen government. Youth detention centres didn't exist. Some of them would have been in a youth detention centre. Within the Mental Health Act, there is no piece of legislation that would allow for locking up someone who is 15 years old in a place like Osler House. They were raped. They were raped. Some of them had day leave. They'd be raped outside of the ward. People took no notice of any of this. People weren't. It was this quiet kind of secret world that it was a little village unto itself that had its own laws.
It also had three cemeteries and its own morgue.
Yes, yeah. I knew about, I didn't know there were three. I knew there were cemeteries, but, and I knew about the morgue that was always smoking. You know, I used to watch the smoke come out of it and think, you know, what's going on with that? What's happening with that? I worked in the Barrett Centre, which is a very, it was the new part of Alston Park. It was the for acute admissions. And one day when I clocked on, there was a five-year-old boy in that ward. It was for adults only. There was a five-year-old boy who was being held there. There was a library in there.
Yes.
And he was inside the library and he was throwing books everywhere. He was throwing chairs at the windows. And, you know, I still can't get it out of my mind that there's a five-year-old in the Barrett Centre. What's he doing here? And they just said there's nowhere else he can go. He's so violent.
So I want to take you to an interview that you did with Joe Beasley for the museum exhibition called Remembering Goodna, which is another name for Wollaston Park. Now, you were interviewed for that exhibition and you recalled a story about your experiences in there. Would you mind recounting that for the listeners?
Yeah, that was a day that was really upsetting for me for a couple of reasons. One, because I had to return to Wollaston Park, which I never wanted to do again. And I guess the story that was picked up and used by Joe was a story about an older woman, very frail, very small woman, who had her own room in Noble House. It was a ward called Noble House. She would be dressed every day in a white hospital kind of gown. It's a kind of gown that you put on now if you go and have a
mammogram or something.
Yeah, you're going for an x-ray or something like that. You know, it's so flimsy and it just ties up at the back. So she's dressed in one of those.
Yes.
You know, like Wollaston Park's quite near, it's in between Ipswich and Brisbane. It's cold. These are cold places. It's nothing for it to be kind of, you know, 3 degrees in the morning. And every morning, like Ethel obviously had dementia. She would paint the walls with her shit and herself, and that's why she was in that single room. And to wake her up, the senior registered nurse would spray her with a fire hose, spray her face, spray her body, spray her bed, spray the room.
And that was every day?
This happened every day that I worked there. And she was terrified. Kerry, she was a terrified woman, probably in her late 70s. And so I decided that I would go in earlier. An early shift starts at 5:45. I would go in about 20 minutes earlier, and I would take her covered in all of her shit, and I would run a deep bath, hot bath, and I bought, like, you know, salts and bubbles and so on, and I would put her in this bath and then let it out and then shower her with warm water so that there was nothing left on her, and then try and find some clothes to dress her in so she wasn't in this gown, this flimsy gown. And I did this for about 3 days. In the evening shift, when I started, the first night.
Okay, so what happened on your first night shift back?
Okay, I came out and my four tires had been slashed, which meant I had four flat tires, which meant I had to ring the RSEQ, and I waited there in the dark.
That must have been very scary. And,
do you know, Kerry, I was more angry than I was scared. I was just more angry. I just get angrier and angrier as I get older. So, thinking about it.
So tell me, that wasn't the only time your tires were slashed. Tell me about the other time.
That was also in Noble House, and it was the same person. But it was in my third year. So in your third year, you've passed enough. And so in my third year, you get to handle the drugs. So I opened the door. I don't know what caused me to open up the door. I don't know what the request was. But I opened up the door, and the same person who had sprayed with a hose was raping an 80-odd, she was 80, in her 80s, he was raping an 80-odd-year woman. She was bending over the counter in the drug room, and I just looked at him, and he knew from my past behavior with Ethel that it wasn't going to be kept quiet.
So what did you do?
I reported it to the nursing school,
mm-hmm.
and to a particularly progressive lecturer there.
Where was the nursing school?
The nursing school was next to the occupational therapy area. It was part of Wollaston Park.
You reported this rape that you saw firsthand. It was a male warden?
Yep, it was a male warden. He'd been in Noble House for ages. Teddy said she would raise it with the head of the nursing school. She came back to me and she said, I've reported it. They've said that they've heard other things about him. And I said to her, you know, it's not a complaint. about his behaviour. I said, it's a complaint. That is about a crime. It's a crime. These people are committing crimes. I said, you can't phrase it as, you know, there's some bad behavior going on. This is criminal. This is about a criminal offense. And Teddy said, you know, I know this, and this is how I've reported it. But he stayed there.
So there was no consequences for him?
No, not that I'm aware of. But then I was in third year then, and I left as soon as I finished third year, oh, like 2 months after I finished third year.
And what happened to you after you reported it?
I was told that I wasn't going to work in that ward ever again.
What happened to your car?
Oh, my tire. Yeah, my tires were slashed.
All four?
Sorry, no, not this time. No, just one. Just one. Just enough that I couldn't go away. I couldn't leave.
And that was a night shift too?
It was always in the dark, so that you were inconvenienced by the fact that it was a long drive back to my place and, you know, calling the RACQ and getting them to come and change your tyres.
Yeah, for those who haven't been to Wolston Park, it's situated in a very remote sort of enclave, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's down near the river. It's actually very spooky. There's hardly, even today, there's hardly any street lighting and there's a lot of bush, and the buildings, from my recollection, was like a village. It was a rabbit warren. There were lots of little roads going off everywhere.
Yes, because there's so many wards.
And there was a lot of and there were big signs that would say laundry, shed, women's bathrooms, men's bathrooms,
cafeteria. Like, you know, it had everything that an institution has. It's like sometimes you're driving, you know, you have to negotiate your way through all the little roads, all the wards.
They sort of also were spread out, and they had an oval in the middle and a cricket pitch and a tennis court and they had all these gardens everywhere.
Yeah.
It was very odd, wasn't it? It was like the house, all these places of horror on the inside, but on the outside, you're inside looking out and you see this beautiful green lawn or oval or
and rose the rose beds.
Yes.
Yeah, the rose beds.
The rose beds. And then you'd see people with Down syndrome who were obviously tindering them, who were, you know, obviously unpaid labor, and they had about 1,000 inmates at the time, so they had a lot of free labor and they had a lot of people with a lot of free time, so you'd see them with wheelbarrows and all sorts of things. Now, not everything about Wolston Park was bleak. I mean, I did have some experiences there visiting my brother where I used to sneak in coffee because they weren't allowed to have coffee, and I used to sneak in biscuits because they'd never had biscuits, and I sneak in. They were allowed to have as many drugs as they liked, as much Valium, as much cigarettes, but they weren't allowed to have coffee.
Yeah, but not coffee.
I just used to think this was bizarre. It was absolutely bizarre, but they had to have the tea in the big, huge teapots.
Oh,
but
the teapots, I know, that were already full of milk and sugar.
And so if you didn't want tea without
milk sugar, or sugar, bad bloody luck, you know.
It's called Rougarou Brew or something.
I know. It was astounding to me the way they used to make these huge teapots full of milk and sugar. It's just like, why can't we just offer people milk and sugar?
You observed something very amusing and a little bit similar. What was that?
Yeah, this is one of the. So to explain this, there were some wards that were locked, and people couldn't get out of, and then there were some wards that were called open wards, where people could just leave if they wanted to. They could go to the cafeteria. They could go and, you know, wander around the grounds or down to the river or, unfortunately, to the railway station where, you know, we experienced a few too many suicides. The thing about the open wards that, you know, some people who were in open wards, they had their own clothes, and those in locked wards just wore these awful grey, white kind of gowns. But there was a day when I was up in the what's called the Nurses Administration building, and it's where the matron is there. It's where you go to get your pay. We were paid in cash in those days. Yeah. Anyway, I was standing up there. I'd gone up there for something. I can't remember what it was. A truck came along. It was backing along, like backing back past the nurses' administration area. And the driver asked a guy who was there. He says, "Look, I've got this kind of gravel. I've got to deliver this gravel and these stones to a place. Can you help me out? Do you know where it's got to go?" And this guy, I'm standing there in a white uniform, like on the veranda watching, and this guy, he's saying, yeah, just back it up here. And I knew he was a patient. And he said, "Just keep backing it up." And he backed it up all the way to the steps of the administration, nurses' administration steps. And he said, "Okay, unload it here, just here." and the driver just, he tipped up this, it was huge. It was this whole kind of truck full of gravel and stones right at the steps. I don't know what was wrong with him. So, anyway, it was this mound of stones and gravel right at the steps of the administration building. And the guy said, "Yep, that's great. That's a great job. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you." And then he looked at me thinking, "Oh, shit, you know, like there's a nurse." And I just looked at him and I went, "It's great. That's great. Good." Anyway, then I thought, "Oh shit, how am I going to get out of here?" I had to scramble across a whole hill of stones and rocks and whatever. And I don't know what happened after that, because, you know, the matron and all that administrative staff and someone would have come out to, you know, go to their cars and whatever. And there would have been this mountain of rocks. I mean, why this guy didn't know where to put the stones, I don't know, but it was just one of the most, it was just one of the greatest memories I have of just a patient just saying, "Here, I'm going to have a go at all of you."
And you let it happen. And
I just watched it happen, and I just thought, I'm not going to stand in the way of this. This is just fantastic.
And then you had visions of these big old matrons climbing over the top of the
rock. Yeah. Rock climbing down. It was beautiful. It was just a beautiful moment.
You know that Walsham Park had its own morgue, and you saw the morgue in operation when you were there in the 1980s.
Mm.
And I've spoken with other patients during the 80s who had other patients die in their arms. There was over 2,300 buried in those three cemeteries over a century. We don't know exactly how many. We have absolutely no idea who they were. So do you think that's odd?
I do. you know, it's kind of like going to a prison, you know, where you're not identified by a name, you're identified by a number.
Yes.
And no one can then go back and say, you know, I want to find my son who died here.
That's right.
But, and no one knows that the further you climb up the hill to where the buses run over to the University of Queensland is a whole buried children's cemetery.
Yes.
And it's underneath a bus line. And who are those children?
Indeed. Could have been that five-year-old boy.
I don't know what happened to that five-year-old boy.
I'm Kerry Carrington, and you've been listening to the podcast series Remembering Randall.